Oceana's sports leader, 96.1 FM, WSBT presents Budweiser's Weekday Sports Beat.
Booger, up and in! With 2 seconds left, Notre Dame leads!
Malpas again, backhands, he scores!
Down to the corner, Jablonski, three is good!
Andrew steps in, he's going to throw deep for T.Y., he's got it!
Flips to Jenkins, three for the win, it's good! Villanova wins it!
He dived, it is a touchdown! New England wins!
Adios! Cubs win their ninth in a row!
Miles Boykin is in the end zone!
The Irish have come back!
Your hosts are Eric Hansen and Darren Pritchett.
And we welcome you to Budweiser's Weekday Sports Beat, presented by Budweiser. Great times are waiting. Grab some Buds on this Friday evening. I'm Darren Pritchett at the Compton Family Ice Arena on the campus of the University of Notre Dame, where tonight the top-ranked Irish hockey team will take on the Ohio State Buckeyes. If Notre Dame wins tonight, they win the outright Big Ten regular season championship in their inaugural run in the grand old Big Ten Conference. It would be the program's third regular season conference championship in their first since 08-09 back in the old CCHA. You can hear Irish hockey tonight on our sister station, Z94.3 FM. Pregame right around 7:20. Faceoff was scheduled to be 7:35. I see on some notes here it's been moved back to 7:40. Somewhere around in there, we'll play some hockey here at Lefty Smith Rink. Eric Hansen is the Fighting Irish football insider for the South Bend Tribune. He joins us on the phone this evening, and someone that just had to travel over the last little bit. I'm not going to tell you anything you don't know. It's really rough out there. The Notre Dame parking lots, as you would expect, it's pretty rough right now. With cars being parked all day, there's really not a whole lot you can do in moving around snow. So if you're coming to the hockey game tonight, I'm going to tell you obvious stuff. It's going to take you a while to get here. It's going to take you a while to park and bring boots because you're going to have to walk through some heavy snow to get to the front door. I mean, the sidewalks are fine. They've been doing a great job, but there's just parts of the parking lot. There's not much you can do. So just give yourself extra time if you're coming out to the Irish hockey game tonight. We're hoping to have a big crowd since they have a chance to win a banner and a ring. But I know it's going to be a tough night of travel for many people. So we'll get as many into the old Lefty Smith Rink as we can tonight for Notre Dame and Ohio State in Big Ten play. What are we going to talk about tonight? Top recruits of the Brian Kelly era. We'll wrap up that conversation. The voice of the Irish basketball team, Jack Nolan, joins us at the bottom of this hour. Later on this hour, Clark Lee, new Notre Dame defensive coordinator. I caught up with him on Wednesday. You'll hear that interview next hour. We've got some Notre Dame basketball conversation. You'll hear Eric and I speak with Mike Elston, associate head coach and defensive line coach of the Fighting Irish. We'll have rapid fire. We'll have an update on Mishawaka Athletics, which has been affected by the snow, including what you would hear on WSBT Radio. And I will preview Notre Dame hockey against the Eric Hansen University, which, of course, is Ohio State. Eric, how the heck are you today?
Well, I'm great. And I thought it was interesting the other day when Nicholas Petit Ferrer chose Ohio State, and he said he was committing to the University of Ohio State. I have not heard it referred to in that fashion, but maybe he'll learn the name of the school when he gets there. The other thing I wanted to ask you was a hockey question.
Okay.
Is Fire. This a gloves and sticks game?
No. I mean, I think winning a regular season conference championship is much better than winning a tournament championship in a conference.
Uh-huh.
But no, I think you save gloves and sticks for advancing to the Frozen Four and winning a national championship. To me, I don't think you do it on a night like tonight, even though I do think it is more important than winning a conference tournament title. But no, I'm going to say no. What do you think?
I wasn't sure. And then my second question is, has anyone ever stormed the ice? You know, like fans, do they ever do that like in basketball? Or is it too slippery?
I would say that's not something I have witnessed, although I've seen the Boston Bruins go into the stands at Madison Square Garden back in the 70s after a fan. If you remember Slapshot, they went into the stands after fans, but I don't think it's the other way around, though.
Okay, sounds good.
We allow the goons just to go into the stands and take care of business. That's why we have them on the hockey team.
That sounds good.
For a little odd tussle. Eric, we're going to talk about top recruits of the Brian Kelly era. You had a piece that ran in the South Bend Tribune and IndyInsider.com. Earlier this week, we went through 16 through 9. And again, this isn't about the star system. Eric takes into account many things, including timing, maybe getting a kid from a certain area, which opened the floodgates to get more players from that area. So it's a really interesting list. And again, my choice for number one is number six. So let's start with number eight on your list, one of my favorite guys.
Right. Well, if this was based on funny meaning really cool highlights of somebody plastering another person, this guy would be number one. And it's Quentin Nelson. And like Jerry Tillery, who was in the first eight from 16 to 9, you know, Quentin was asked to move positions shortly after coming to Notre Dame. He was a five-star recruit, number three offensive tackle in the country. And then he gets to Notre Dame, and here he goes, "How'd you like to play guard, Harry Hiestand?" And he unselfishly did that and trusted Harry. And he turns out to be kind of a once-in-a-generation kind of offensive guard as far as the NFL is concerned. And certainly he was a unanimous All-American, one of only three offensive linemen in the last 97 years to win Notre Dame's MVP award. But I think what's really significant about Quentin is, besides the Joe Moore Award, the All-American, and a 10-win season this year, is he was a five-star guy that actually didn't just meet expectations. He exceeded them.
Yeah, no question. Could be a top five pick in the NFL draft, depending on how the old quarterback situation shakes out. Eric, number seven on your list, we go to the quarterback position.
Right, DeShone Kizer, and this might be high, but you got to think about how the 2015 season played into the Brian Kelly era. And if DeShone Kizer doesn't improve the way he did, you know, as a redshirt freshman and just keep getting better that year, you know, then Brian Kelly may be looking at two losing seasons in a row, and that's kind of the end of the Kelly era. As far as his recruitment, there wasn't unanimity among the Irish coaches when they went after him. He was a three-star prospect. He was non-250. And they were really trying to get a kid named Kyle Allen, who ended up going to Texas A&M. But, you know, the argument with Kizer was he had flawed mechanics, threw too much like a baseball player, kind of long lever guy, and he was a baseball player as well. But Kelly liked his passion and potential when they took him.
Right.
And he is by far the statistically the most successful quarterback of the Brian Kelly era. And he's the only one to get drafted. And he was an early entry at round two, no less. And when you talk about the list of Kelly quarterbacks, I mean, there's two five-stars on that list. And Kizer certainly outperformed them. So, you know, based on that context, I have Kizer at number seven.
Going through Eric's list from the South Bend Tribune, top recruits of the Brian Kelly era, we're up to number six. And as I mentioned, I thought this would be number one, and that is a heck of a football player from Fort Wayne. He was a five-star, Jalen Smith. I mean, that's a marquee player come to your football team. Why was number six the right spot for him?
Well, if you based it on pure talent and intangibles, you could really make a case for him being number one, and I'm sure that's what you're thinking.
Yes.
But I think he was a victim of circumstance. You know, having to spend his final two seasons under Brian Van Gorder and in that system, you know, basically his last two, well, his 3 years at Notre Dame, he never played on a defense that was higher than 70th in rushing. And in the two Van Gorder years, they ranked 71st and 45th in total defense. And basically, in that flawed scheme, he was kind of relegated to be an eraser for his teammates' mental mistakes, and most of that brought on by it being too complex. And I think the other thing that hurts Jalen in this, he's a guy that should have had a larger legacy in terms of players coming, being recruited to play with him, players recruited after him.
Interesting.
But Van Gorder was just so indifferent in recruiting, it really kept them from capitalizing him on Smith as a centerpiece in their recruiting. And so by no fault of his own, he ends up at number six.
Well, and Eric, that's a guy that should have been unleashed to go after the quarterback a little more, too. I think we all agree with that.
Absolutely.
But that's not on
him. And when I talk to Brian Kelly, I do these audio things for the magazine because we have a tablet version. And one of the questions was, you know, if you could say something different, you know, if you could change something different about Jalen Smith's college career, what would it be? He goes, I would have used him a lot differently. I would have used him to his strengths more and to our strengths. Yeah. So I think there's a lot of regret there with Brian Kelly kind of trusting Brian Van Gorder on how to use Jalen Smith most effectively.
Well, number five on the list, we know he can talk. He's as good a talker as we've had the last 10 years. But how about Kavari Russell coming in at number five on your top recruits of the Kelly era list?
Right. I mean, he was a four-star kid, and he was number 124. So that's a pretty good prospect. He was supposed to be good in college, just not at that position, which was cornerback. He was recruited as a running back, and then they brought him in the summer and had him work as a slot receiver. And then 27 days before the 2012 opener, they said, Kavari, we really need you to learn how to play cornerback. And the only time he had played corner in high school at Mariner High in Everett was basically against his will. He had, you know, kind of tanked it in drills so they wouldn't use him there. He didn't want to play it. So he was basically starting from scratch. The reason that I kind of got to Kavari was they lost Ronald Darby late in the recruiting cycle to Florida State. They swung and missed at a handful of other really good corners. Early enrollee T. Shepard, they thought, okay, maybe he could start. He had an academic snag right before the start of spring practice and left Notre Dame. And then they said, okay, let's go with Low Wood. He's a veteran. He suffers a season-ending injury right before it started. So Russell was really the last resort. But his willingness to be able to play in a familiar position and his ability to take that on helped Notre Dame get to the 2012 championship game. If you had put somebody else there, you know, I think that would have been maybe enough to expose that secondary, which was pretty young and inexperienced. Thought it was interesting, too, in the early part of the Kelly era, 40% of the players recruited between 2010 and 2014 who didn't eventually transfer, they ended up making at least one position switch. Now, we haven't seen as many of those in the later Kelly years, but early in Kelly years, that was kind of his signature, one of his signature traits as a coach, if you will. And Kavari Russell was probably one of his most successful, if not the most successful.
Eric and Darren with you. Sports Beat brought to you by Budweiser, top recruits of the Brian Kelly era. We have brought one of Eric's stories in the Tribune to life here on the radio. And out of the 16 players you talked about, I would say controversial, maybe not the right word to use, but this one probably caught a lot of people off guard. You have Everett Golson at number four. Why?
I do. And again, a lot of it ties into good teams or great teams. And, you know, Everett, you know, I could have docked him a little bit and knocked him down because of self-inflicted wounds. He was an academic misconduct incident that knocked out the 2013 season. He kind of imploded at the end of 2014. Then he transferred to Florida State and kind of went into a tailspin there. But the timing and the ability to execute his complementary role on the 2012 team, that's elevated him to a top five recruit to me. This is why, Darren, you know, Brian Kelly was kind of saying, well, you know what, I inherited square pegs. I have Tommy Reese and Dave Crist, and we can only do so much with this offense. He needed to highlight a guy that he recruited for a whole cycle and that he could say, you know, he can play in this offense. This is what our offense is supposed to look like. And he swung and missed on a kid named Bubba Starling that ended up playing minor league baseball and I think might even make the Royals roster. And then poached Golson out of North Carolina's class. And so, again, he was the first guy. Had Golson not been as successful, had they not had run in the national championship had he had maybe his second half of 2014 stats in 2012, then I think the Brian Kelly era would have gone very different. He would have had trouble recruiting Zaire and Kizer based on the fact that here's his guy and he could not elevate his play.
Down to our final three on the top recruits of the Kelly era. According to Eric, we have to roll through these a little quicker. Number three, you went with Chocolate Thunder.
Right. Well, he was the
Lewis
top
Nix,
prospect
by the way.
In Kelly's first, in his first recruiting class. He actually, the mythology is that he recruited between Weiss and Kelly, and he publicly did that he had committed to Weiss a long time before. But here, this was the first out-of-profile recruit in the Kelly era, where it was a high school where kids didn't go to Notre Dame from that high school. They had never sent a kid there. And then they plugged him into Bob Diaco's 34 defense, and this is where the 34 really got its punch and, again, helped Notre Dame get to the 2012 championship. They have been thin on nose guards ever since. They haven't really had somebody quite like Lewis Nix. Maybe some of these young guys can fill that role.
Number two, Eric, we don't have to go very far back to talk about this guy. In fact, this guy hasn't played a down for the Irish yet. You put Phil Jurkovec at number two.
Right, and I think that will probably raise some eyebrows too. But fairly or not, he's the player most likely to define the final chapters of the Kelly era whenever that comes. His contract pays him through 2021. But there's so many perceptual things here. His longstanding commitment, he committed before the 2016 season. So him not wavering during that 2016 4-18 season, his ability to pull other players into the 2018 class really helped Notre Dame turn things around and help Brian Kelly kind of get a second win. And the other thing is he could end up being the best quarterback of the Brian Kelly era. We're going to have to wait and see if that happens, but he certainly has that kind of potential.
And we're up to number one, in your opinion, Eric. The top recruit of the Brian Kelly era is Stephon Tuitt, who's having a heck of a go with the Pittsburgh Steelers.
Well, yeah, he was. And in his first full recruiting cycle, which was 2011, Kelly was able to do something Weiss was never able to do, and that was land a five-star defensive lineman. Weiss actually didn't land a five-star recruit on the defensive side of the ball until his very last verbal commitment of his era, and that was Manti Te'o. And together, Tua and Te'o were kind of the faces of the defense that put them into the national championship game with some historic numbers. And again, from Kelly, the significance of getting his first five-star of any kind was that Kelly had only landed two players higher than three stars in his six cycles as a FBS coach before coming to Notre Dame. And he's the first of nine five-stars. He came from SEC country, and they had to go through a lot of drama with Georgia Tech to keep him in the class.
I remember that well. Stephon Tuitt, number one on Eric's list, top recruits of the Brian Kelly era. One other note, Pro Day coming up. I noticed Mike Varell, your colleague, tweeted about this today. Looks like Malik Zaire's coming back to Notre Dame Pro Day to throw the football around a little bit.
Absolutely, and I saw Evan Sharpley tweet about that as well. But that's not unusual for grad transfers in the last few pro days. Everett Golson did it. Jake Bolick. There's been a handful of guys. Matt Hagerty, a center from Oregon, came back. So I think it will help the receivers and the running backs, because otherwise you kind of have to find somebody, that hasn't worked with these guys much. At least there's some chemistry there that they can rekindle on pro day.
Eric Hansen, Darren Pritchett, Sports Beat brought to you by Budweiser. Great times are waiting. Grab some Buds. Notre Dame basketball hosts Florida State tomorrow at 4 o'clock. And we have to talk about that matchup with Jack Nolan, the voice of the Irish basketball team. That conversation is next on 96.1 FM WSBT. I'm Darren Pritchett at the Compton Family Ice Arena. Eric Hansen joining us on the phone tonight. Also joining us on the phone, the voice of the Fighting Irish basketball team, Jack Nolan. Notre Dame will host Florida State at 4 o'clock here on WSBT Radio, 3:40 pregame. Then they hop on a flight Sunday, I'm assuming. for Chapel Hill to take on North Carolina on Monday. But the Irish coming off a win over Boston College this week, in which they scored 96 points. Jack, good to talk to you. How are you today?
Just fine, Darren. How are you? You got a big weekend coming up.
Pretty big weekend. I'm glad I'm in the parking lot already, because it's going to be one of those rough nights for people to get in and out of the University of Notre Dame. It's just the snow's not going to let up, and this should feel just right at home for Florida State coming to town as they have to deal with the snow for a couple of days. But as we take a look, Jack, at this Irish basketball team, after eight straight games shooting below 40%, they ripped the nets against BC for over 50%. Give me your analysis on what you saw against the Eagles that worked so well and how you think it could translate to this team's success the rest of the way.
Well, I saw the Notre Dame offense that we're all used to. And a big part of that was they actually got to practice for two full days without anybody getting injured, with the nucleus of players that were going to be on the floor, and they'd had a little bit of the advantage that Matt Farrell then had been back for about a week. Mike Bray's offenses have always been read and react, unconscious competence, where it works because the guys have the experience and they know what they're supposed to be doing. With all of the changes, and it seemed, you know, they went the first eight games, they never started the same starting lineup in consecutive games, and they started seven different lineups. That doesn't work for this offense. So you've got guys who are not comfortable. You've got guys in roles they hadn't been in, some rushing shots, not rushing shots. Rex Kluger's proven he can make big shots when it's part of the flow of the game. He's also proven right now he's not comfortable being a guy that's supposed to take six, seven, eight three-point shots in a game. So they were all in different roles. They just weren't comfortable. They got comfortable against Boston College, and thank goodness that they did, because Jerome Robinson put on the greatest opposing offensive effort in the history of Purcell Pavilion with 46. But I think if they can continue to play the way they did against BC, and I saw it today, they were flowing, they were moving, they were confident. I think that brighter things are ahead for this Notre Dame team. There is nothing that will replace the preseason ACC Player of the Year other than hopefully a healthy preseason Bonzi Colson or regular season Bonzi Colson returning. But, you know, this team, they changed themselves. They became a dominant offensive rebounding team, and that's a first under Mike Bray. But this team needs to score to have a chance. If they can continue to defend well, and they did defend well throughout the stretch, other than the NC State game and the closing moments of the Duke game, if they continue to do all that little dirty work they were doing and make some baskets, I think folks can expect some more wins before this year's up.
Jack, this is Eric Hansen. I'm curious about a couple things you mentioned. One, when you said brighter things could be ahead, what do you feel like is still out there for them as the best case scenario? The second part of it is, you know, you're around Bonzi a lot more than just about anybody. Do you sense that he might be making the kind of progress that would get him on the court at least before the ACC tournament?
He appears to be. The x-ray was good. The x-ray that they're taking another x-ray coming up. He says he feels good. But it's just going to be down to what the MRIs and x-rays say in terms of the bone growth. I know he wants to come back, but some of it will be, you know, what's at stake, I think, as well. And what's best for him. That is something that they are very concerned about. They want to make sure that he has the best possible opportunity to impress NBA scouts. Because let's remember, we know Bonzi, we love Bonzi. I've talked to NBA scouts, they're intrigued. He's not going to pay the same penalty that a lot of 6'6 forwards in college will pay, because he's shown what he can do in the post against much larger players. But still, he's a shooting guard in the NBA size-wise if you try to fit him into that peg. So he's going to have to show people in those training camps and in those visits, and they want to make sure, Mike Bray in particular, that he's as healthy as he can possibly be. So if there's any risk that it will, you know, diminish his chances to advance, they're going to be very cautious with him. And then, are we talking about an NCAA tournament? If Notre Dame goes on a roll here and Bonzi comes back and DJ Harvey comes back, I think the committee will look at some of those losses that they were losses due to injuries. I think they still have a shot at the NCAA tournament. I'll be honest with you. I think it's an uphill battle. I think it's an outside shot, but it is still there. When you look at the games remaining, there's a lot of winnable games remaining for this team if they play the way they did against BC.
The voice of the Irish basketball team, Jack Nolan, our guest here on 96.1 FM WSBT. Amidst all the injuries, you have seen the evolution of TJ Gibbs. Now, he was evolving even before all the chaos started. You take a look at the Maui Invitational. He had games that just... he started to get our attention, and I don't know if I ever saw the offensive game coming early in his career, but all of a sudden, with bodies going down and opportunities coming about, I mean, Jack, he seems like a marquee guy for this program the next couple of years. Give us some insight on what makes TJ Gibbs tick, and did you see this evolution coming this year, or did you think it was maybe a year away?
I thought it was a year away. It was forced upon him this year, and I give him credit. He grabbed the situation, and he moved forward. And he did what the team needed him to do. Now, that said, it's to remember, go back to the season opener, which seems like a decade ago, the game at DePaul. That's a dangerous game for a team to start with, for a major team. You're going to another power conference site. It was the dedication game, the opening game for their new arena. If anything goes wrong, you can pick up, you can start with a loss. There's very much less room for error. And I know that DePaul's not what they've been, but they still have the capability of beating you in a first game if you don't play well. And Notre Dame was struggling early, and it was TJ that took over that game and made shots. So he came in, he wanted to be and expected to be a major cog for this team this year. Did I expect him to be a guy who could take over and basically guide this team to victories and be a huge force, be the main guy? I knew it was down the road. I didn't think it would be this quick, and I admire the way that he's done it. He's coming off 28 points, a career high against BC. The two half-court buzzer beaters at the end of halves, actually the last one was a runner that I actually thought was a two because he landed by the foul line almost, but he took off in three-point land. But he's become a real leader of this team. I just think that the situation has accelerated the program, and he has had the focus and drive to be able to advance his own progress. And give him credit, he lost 17 pounds in the offseason, and he did that on his own. The team didn't tell him to do it. He just knew he had to. He knew he had to get quicker. He knew he got a little tired last year, that if he was going to be a key player, he had to be in better shape, and he got in better shape. And I agree with you. I mean, it's going to be his team from a point guard perspective the next 2 years. And I know Coach Gray likes it when they take Matt Farrell off the ball right now, and I think Matt likes it too, because he gets some of his little three-point barrages he's had since he's come back from the injury. Some of those threes have been when he has been off the ball. It frees him up to get better shots than sometimes he can get when he's got the ball.
Jack, there seems like there's been times because of the injuries we've almost got a glimpse of how Mike is going to try to put this team together next year. Now, obviously, Juwan Durham would be a big part of that, and maybe some of the incoming freshmen, but I'm curious if you kind of see the pieces coming together for next year's team. Not that they're playing for next year already, but have you seen kind of maybe what this team might be like? And then also, if you maybe can, if Juwan is actually practicing, give us a little scouting report on his game.
He is practicing, and he's healthy now, but he missed some time. He's the kind of guy, Notre Dame really hasn't had a guy like him in a long, long time. He's really lanky, very lengthy. He's a game changer around the basket. He can score around the basket with sky hooks and, you know, get a lot of dump-offs and a very aggressive driver. He's got a jump shot. There are days when it's going down and days that it does not. He gets up and down the floor pretty much for a big guy, but he's got the frame that can change games. I think it's going to be very interesting what next year's team looks like, and it's one of the reasons they're going to go on the foreign trip to the Bahamas in August for 7 days so that they can go ahead and get some games in down there. Because the young guys, you're bringing in five signees with Juwan at six, and four of the guys are in the top 100. And you've got somebody at virtually every position. You've got some great ball handlers. You've got Jay Lazuski's coming in, who's 6'10". And when I look at him, I ain't saying, I see North Carolina. He looks like a North Carolina 6'10 forward who can knock down threes, run the floor. Looks like Johnson from North Carolina last year. So I think those young guys are going to play a huge part in it. So I'm not sure. I think what you're doing now is you have gotten, Mike will have a lot of the answers he otherwise would not have had, because all the guys on the bench have played and will play a lot, and they will be given opportunities. Nick Jogo, Elijah Burns are all playing a lot, and I think that, I'm not saying that their fates next year are being decided now, but I think Coach Gray's going to have a much better idea of what he has because of how much they've had to play this year.
Jack, as we look ahead to tomorrow, 4 o'clock tip here on WSBT Radio, you'll have the call of the Notre Dame-Florida State game. What part of Notre Dame's game could be very effective against Florida State tomorrow?
Well, Florida State gives up a lot of points. In ACC play, they are last in the league at getting up points. So offense, getting out, running on them, making some shots. I mean, they made 16 threes the other night. It's a big reason why they won, and you can't expect them to make 16 a night. But that's going to be a big part of it. And then just being smart on defense, rebounding. Chris Camaggi is still there. They're 7'4" center, the tallest player in the history of Florida State. So you certainly can't let him dominate the boards. You still have to get to the boards. And transition defense, getting back and being smart and making Florida State play a half-court game. They're pretty good at three-point shooting as well. They're either the second or third highest scoring team in ACC play. So they're going to put points on the board. So you want to try to slow them down, and you got to score. I think the rest of the year, this Notre Dame team has got to score. But I like some of the things done, guys, in terms of Notre Dame is a much better rebounding team than they were before Bonzi went down collectively. They have to keep doing that, especially on the offensive rebounding end. And they've had to defend a lot to stay in a lot of these games when, as you mentioned, they went through that long stretch where they were shooting under 40%. That all has to stay. And if you add an effective offense to that, you have a shot to win each and every game. But it's another athletic, explosive Florida State team. I don't think they're quite as good as they were last year, certainly not. They don't have as many huge bodies around the basket, certainly not experienced huge bodies. They have two big post guys who are going to come off the bench again to fill in for Camaggi, who are kind of game changers with their size. I don't think they're quite as good, and I think it's certainly a very winnable game. And I think Notre Dame looks at it really for, and again, Eric, you asked me, what's the ceiling? I think they can still make the NCAA tournament. I do think it's a long shot. But they think that tomorrow's game is huge because they really have to protect their home court the rest of the way. And you've got a Miami challenge on Monday night that's going to be even harder to get. So it's a huge game for them. So continue to defend, continue to rebound. Do not let Florida State score a lot in transition, because that's what they really want to do, and make some shots.
Jack, last one from me. John Mooney's numbers are impressive. And I'm just curious what you think is still out there for him in terms of improvement or adding to his game the rest of this season.
I think he's got nothing but upside now and in the future. He is a stretch four who can make threes. He's gotten confidence there. I mean, maybe be a little even more aggressive with his shot. He's still passing up some shots. I think he's shooting right now 63% from three, his last four healthy games. Throw NC State out. He was out there for 8 minutes. He couldn't do anything on that sprained ankle. He's a very good rebounder, Eric. I mean, I think he's one of those guys who's going to be very difficult to guard, because he can play inside, but he can pull who's ever guarding him outside into three-point land, and he's not a bad defender, and he's a pretty good rebounder. I think he just has to get more aggressive, continue to gain confidence, and I honestly think during this stretch, the light came on 5 games ago, during this stretch he gets better each and every game. I don't think we're close to the ceiling that he has in any way, because I think he can be, he started in the last game also, he took some guys off the dribble. I know Coach Gray talked to him about that afterwards. You hadn't seen John Mooney take people off the dribble. So now you've got a big guy who can hit threes, but if you go for his pump fake, he can take it to the basket. I mean, I think he's less than 50% to what he can be at this point in the season.
Jack will have the call tomorrow.
That's by the end of his career.
Right. Jack will have the call of Notre Dame, Florida State tomorrow at 4 o'clock here on WSBT Radio, pregame at 3:40. Jack, thanks for doing this. Have a great call tomorrow, and good luck to the guys against Florida State.
Well, and I will throw, and I agree with this. Mike Gray says that one of the biggest things why this team has been able to stay alive has been the crowd. So I think the snow should be done by tomorrow. The 1978 Final Four team will be there and honored at halftime, so it should be a great afternoon. But I asked both Bonzi and Rex Pfluger on the radio show last night, Coach Gray's radio show, how much the crowd helps them. Because, again, we all talk about it, but does it really help? And they both said, especially Bonzi said, he feeds off that energy, that it gives him a noticeable lift. So, folks, fans who like to say we, you can be we now, because there's only three home teams left. They need you to come on out and help this team, because if they can get these three home games, get a couple on the road, you may well get yourself back into that NCAA tournament. And we weren't really thinking about that, getting on the plane after the game at Duke or NC State last week.
Yeah, I almost jumped off the ship after NC State, but I'm glad they bounced back against BC and you win against Florida State. A lot of opportunities ahead. Jack, thank you so much. We'll be in touch soon, and
My pleasure, good luck to the
Irish tomorrow.
All right, good. Thanks. Thanks to both of you. Get some rest, Derek.
Take care.
That's Jack Nolan, the voice of the Irish basketball team. It is now 14 minutes in front of the top of the hour. Next, you're going to hear from Irish defensive coordinator Clark Lee as SportsBeat continues on WSBT. SportsBeat continues on 96.1 FM WSBT. I'm Darren Pritchett at the Compton Family Ice Arena. Wednesday was National Signing Day for high school football players, at least the second version for the class of 2018. And Notre Dame gave us the opportunity to talk to football assistant coaches, and I had the chance to speak with the brand new defensive coordinator of the Fighting Irish, Clark Lee.
Well, Clark, a busy day for this football program. Noah Boykin comes in at the last second. Your thoughts on him and the quarterback haul you guys had in this class?
You know, Noah is a long, competitive, athletic, plays both ways. There's just no way that he doesn't enhance your roster. And so we're thrilled to have him. You know, the thing that people don't know about Noah is, you know, this is a guy that in the summers was doing academic camps and like digging into his schoolwork, and just in every way has distinguished himself throughout his life. And so I'm anxious for him to come to Notre Dame and be able to do that here. You know, outside of Noah, we've got a really talented secondary group coming in, and specifically the corners with Joe and Tariq. You have again two-way players that are dynamic athletes you know, we're thrilled to have. Both have unique skill sets that'll be able to come in and make a difference. Houston, who's already here, is a guy that you know, we've been really pleased with how he's acclimated, and coming from IMG, he should. You know, he's been trained at the highest level, and so that's been not a pleasant surprise, but it's been just neat to see that come to fruition. So that's been cool. And then DJ Brown, I mean, DJ, you know, you just don't see a lot of the 6'1", 190 frames walking around. Not to mention the fact that he's from a fit school. Not to mention the fact that he exudes Notre Dame when he talks to him in person. And so he's got big things ahead for him too. We're excited to have him. All those guys will find their way into roles here early, I would imagine. And you know, I think we've enhanced our length and athleticism back there, which is great.
Houston is penciled in as a boundary corner right now. What part of his skill set makes him a good fit there for right now?
Yeah, well, I think it's the boundary corner is a spot where you need to be physical, because that guy is going to be counted into the run game more so than the field corner. You need to be able to blitz. So those guys are generally like kind of bigger bodied alpha personalities. And then when you play like 3-by-1 sets, that guy is in a lot of instances kind of locked up on the X receiver. And so again, that alpha mindset, that kind of things get on you fast over there. And so you need to be able to just react. That's where we think he can do it. But those guys will all, as they come in, They'll learn both. And at the end of the day, you know, the field corner being a little more technical, things happen a little slower, but needing a little more discipline when it comes to staying on top of routes and staying in between routes. These guys will be able to do both.
Now, this guy I'm going to ask you about is not, of course, a signee, but you got to know a lot about Aloy Gilman over the past year. What did you learn about him just seeing him in the practice setting? And also, it sounds like he was so good at times that you almost had to take him out of scout teams.
Yeah, I heard that from the offensive coaches. And you love that because it would be easy for him to see this year as a year where he's just taken off biding his time. And he didn't. You know, he poured in. I mean, that guy was on our sideline in street clothes all year. You know, he is unique. He is, his leadership qualities from two standpoints. One, he's been trained as a leader, and I talked to him about this the other day. I mean, you know, his experience at Navy is formative. I mean, he was trained as a leader at the highest level, and that's going to make him unique in this setting, and he's prepared for it. But beyond that, his ability to relate with his teammates. I mean, I've never seen a guy that's so infectious in a positive way. I mean, just charismatic. The guys like him. In a short amount of time, he made really close friends and tight relationships. And so that is breeding grounds for a dynamic leader, you know. And I think in his mind, he's got to go out and perform, but he has the confidence to do that. And so I'm anxious to see him grow and develop in that leadership role and hopefully add another dynamic player in the middle of our defense.
Clark, after Coach Kelly was done with the media, we had the chance to talk to him for an interview back in his office, and he was describing just how much of an impact Drew Tranquil had on this football team, and he was discussing, you know, the move to the Buck linebacker spot, just how good of a fit is he, and it seems to get pretty good depth at the Rover position to make this particular move.
Well, we want to enhance not only the defensive output, but the opportunity for each player to reach their potential. And so for Drew, you know, he's played Buck already. He played it on third down. And so, you know, he has positional flexibility, not to mention the fact that he's one of the most powerful guys on our roster. And so, you know, that's a natural thing to take a look at to see if it fits him and see if he can do it at a high level. And, you know, as we've been able to bring in long athletic players, that's the, you know, the Rover position. And so having those body types out there will allow for us to have some positional flexibility, which will allow us to put the best three on the field.
Sure seems like you brought in a pretty good Rover in Shane Simon.
Yeah, I think, a complete Notre Dame fit. A guy that's a competitor, that's a winner, and you know, on top of that, a really talented athlete.
Just a couple of thoughts from you on looking ahead to next fall. I would assume the defense foundation stays the same with some of your tweaks?
Defense foundation stays the same. My tweaks won't be my tweaks. It'll be as we watch the season as a staff. How do we need to evolve the package? You know, what does the modern offense require of us to defend? And then, you know, my personality interjected in certain areas, but the continuity piece is the most important. And I want these guys to know the calls, to know how they're lining up, to know how they're playing, and that way we can be as fast and as physical as we possibly can.
Finally, what a remarkable year by Tavon Coney, helping this defense become what it was in 2017. I'm not sure how much you can offer, but he had a big decision to make whether to go to the NFL or not. What type of input did you give him? Again, what you can tell us.
Well, I don't mind sharing with the first conversation is, hey, Tavon, everything that I'm going to tell you from this point forward is biased because I want you back. I want to coach you. And then from there, you gain a level of trust where you can actually have a real conversation. And you just try to tell him what type of experience awaits them here, how you feel like you can improve and enhance their current skill set and give them a launch point for the career that awaits them down the road. On the flip side, you know, I think it's important that you take a turn in their shoes and say, hey, Tavon, this is why you would leave, you know, I mean, and understand that and appreciate that. Because at the end of the day, as biased as we are, our job is to support these guys. And that's a huge life decision and one that when it's made, you know, you can only cast off once. And you want them to be as prepared as they can be, but you want them, more importantly, to know that, hey, you have their back and you're supporting them and you're going to have them their best interest in mind no matter what.
Clark, thanks for the time. Greatly appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
That's new defensive coordinator of the Fighting Irish, Clark Lee. I'm Darren Pritchett at the Compton. More Sports Beat next on WSBT.
Here's Eric Hansen with what's coming up in tomorrow's South Bend Tribune Sports Section.
Tom Noy has an advance on the Florida State Notre Dame's men's hoop game tomorrow. He also has a feature on Marion basketball standout Megan Urbanski. Mike has all the latest on Malik Zaire coming to Notre Dame's Pro Day. We have the Big Ten showdown in hockey where no gloves or sticks will be thrown. Notre Dame versus Ohio State and much, much more.
Eric, have a great weekend. We'll talk to you Monday.
You too.
It's the top of the hour at WSBT South Bend.
Michiana's sports leader, 96.1 FM, WSBT presents Budweiser's Weekday Sports Beat.
Booger, up right in with 2 seconds left. Notre Dame leads.
Malpas again, backhands, he scores.
Down to the corner, Jablonski, three is good.
Andrew steps in, he's going to throw deep for T.Y. He's got it.
Flips to Jenkins, three for the win, it's good. Villanova wins it.
He tied, it is a touchdown. New England wins.
Adios! Cubs win their ninth in a row.
Miles Boykin is in the end zone. The Irish have come back.
Here are your hosts, Darren Pritchett and Sean Stiers.
Second hour of Sports Beat for this Friday. Thanks for joining us. Sports Beat brought to you by Budweiser. Great times are waiting. Grab some Buds. Sean back in our WSBT studios. I'm Darren Pritchett at the Compton Family Ice Arena on the campus of the University of Notre Dame. 7:35 faceoff tonight as it is number one Notre Dame taking on number six Ohio State. The Irish can clinch the Big Ten regular season title with a victory. They need 3 points, so a shootout win would draw them into a tie, worst case, but 3 points, a regulation or overtime win, and they are Big Ten regular season champions. The gates will open right around 6:30. That's about 22 minutes away. And again, I'm stating the absolute obvious. It is treacherous on the roads. The parking lot's obviously here. You can't do a whole lot when there's a lot of cars in the parking lot. So you've got some deep snow in places. So make sure you wear boots and give yourself plenty of time if you're coming to tonight's Fighting Irish hockey game. And hopefully by tomorrow when Notre Dame takes on Florida State in men's basketball at 4 and then hockey plays at 7:05. The snow will have stopped at least for a little bit, although I think, Sean, looking at some of the updated forecasts, I'm not overly confident that Friday and Saturday is going to be quiet weather-wise. Maybe not like this. I mean, we're in Snowmageddon right now,
no
but
kidding.
I don't think it's going to get any easier the next couple of days.
We can only hope, but like you said, it looks like it's just going to keep on coming. So keep the snowblowers gassed up and ready to go.
Somebody who works for the South Bend Cubs walked in my booth and said, oh, yeah, 59 days till opening day, and I laughed. Yeah, I'm like, yeah, I mean, I sure can tell. But you know what? You know what will happen? On opening day, it'll be 80 degrees.
That'd be nice. I would take that at this point. I would sign up for that.
the first ever South Bend Cub game in 2015, it was 75 degrees, believe it or not.
Nice.
Worked out very well, but, well, if there is a game on opening day, I guess I'll take it at this point. We just continue to get punched in the face with this snow and cold. We haven't had a break. It's just been nonstop. So I'm kind of over it. I'm yelling uncle right now.
That's done. I mean, a week ago there was nothing on the ground, and now we're buried in the stuff again. Like you said, we get these little windows just enough. Everything melts. Here it comes. I'm with you. I'm completely over it. I'm done with the whole thing. But we're not going to be in Florida anytime soon, so.
No, and I was watching some of the Pebble Beach Pro-Am on the Golf Channel this afternoon. I actually have it on my booth right now. And you know how frustrating the game of golf is. And Roy McIlroy on a drivable par 4 put it on the front of the green, and then he ended up taking 5 shots to get it in the hole. He made a double bogey on a par 4 that he almost drove. I'm thinking, you know what? That's something that would really tick you off, but right now, with the snow here, I would just be happy to shoot an 8 on any hole right now anywhere in the world.
That's exactly
I promise, right. Golf guys, I would not get mad like I normally do. I would just take it and laugh at this particular moment.
That's exactly right.
All right, we're going to hear from Mike Elston, associate head coach of the Fighting Irish and defensive line coach coming up. We've got rapid fire. I think you're going to update us on some Mishawaka athletic updates because a lot of things are changing right now with this weather in terms of high school sports, and I'll set up tonight's Notre Dame hockey game a little later on. We have the voice of the Irish, Jack Nolan, on in the first hour of the program. Let's just spend a couple of moments on the Irish basketball team. Florida State in town, 4 o'clock tip tomorrow on 96.1 FM WSBT. So from your standpoint, and this is one of the things I asked Jack about, is it realistic to expect the same offensive flow against Florida State that we saw against Boston College? Now, I will tell you, he said that they had it in practice today again.
Well,
so I guess there's a chance of that happening. So I guess just as you look at this game, do you expect the flow to be similar? Do you expect them to have a good shooting day against Florida State?
Well, I think they were definitely a team in search of some confidence the other night, and they managed to find it. Maybe that's kind of the spark. If Jack was saying they still had that same pop in practice, then maybe we'll see some carryover. I mean, I don't think we can expect to see them come out and shoot 52% again like they did against BC. But then again, I'm of the opinion that I don't know that I'll be surprised by anything that happens in college basketball.
Yeah,
this year, the way this season is going.
St. John's?
That's right. Yeah, St. John's beats Duke. But, I mean, this BC team beat Duke as well earlier, and then they got pounded by the same North Carolina team that beat Duke last night. So, again, I just... The one thing that you can look at is the numbers, because we have a pretty good idea of who these teams are at this point. Florida State's given up about 73 points a game, sitting down at the bottom of the ACC. So I think it's very feasible for Notre Dame to come out and get things rolling again offensively. Again, they might not necessarily shoot 52%, but 42 to 45% isn't it's not bad either. Florida State does score, though. They're averaging 84 a game offensively. So, again, I don't think we're going to see five guys come out and get 13-plus points for Notre Dame, but I think we could easily see a game in the 80s tomorrow. And just based on the way this team is built right now, I think Notre Dame has to be shooting for between 70 and probably 80, 85 points a game the rest of the way. They're going to have to come out and be that offensive team that we've grown to know over the years, not the defensive team maybe that we've seen the last couple of years. They're going to have to score some points to win.
Sean, you were gone earlier this week, and Tom Noy was filling in. And before the BC game, we both felt like the best chance for this offense to get going was tighten up the rotation. There were too many guys that were playing that was slowing down the offense. And we have seen through history, when they go with two bigs, it just does not work as well as four out and one in. But I really felt like there were just too many guys deep down the roster that I totally get why Mike had to play because of the numbers. But was it time to take a look at shrinking that number, especially getting Mooney back? Now, that helps to have this plan, so to speak, come to fruition. But I really think shortening the rotation did two things. Number one, they got into a rhythm with basically the same guys on the floor most of the time. And number two, even though they played a little bit, there was a couple of guys that don't bring you a lot offensively that slows down the offense. I think that helped the offense too. So you had five guys flowing, working together, moving the ball. Farrell and Gibbs have been great. Mooney has been outstanding. Pfluger got going, and Gevin was Gevin. So if you can ride those five as much as you can, and that's probably a couple of those guys, it's only 30 minutes out of 40, but I'll take that. And then you got to mix in some other guys. But I really think shortening the rotation had as much to do with finding that rhythm and flow as anything else. Plus, again, you had the same guys out there, so they kind of found something.
Yeah, and you had, what were there, five guys as well. The guys who scored in double figures are the guys who were also 30-plus minutes a game, and then you had three other guys just kind of helping out. Jogo, Burns, and Torres really just spelling guys, and those are the guys who are at the lower end of the offensive spectrum right now. So that's a good point. I agree with that. And not only did you get Mooney back, but now you've had Farrell back for a couple of games, and him being one of those guys who can take on more minutes. Plus Gibbs seems like he's going to be out there 39, 40 minutes a game right now. Because you look back to the Duke game and the NC State game, I mean, Mike Bray was just, when they struggled offensively, he just kind of kept trying more combinations, subbing more guys, and could just never find the fit. And I agree, when you've got these kind of guys, these specific guys, Gebbin, Pflugger, Farrell, mm-hmm. Gibbs, and then Mooney as your anchors out there. And those are all guys who can score, and they're the ones getting the more minutes. I think that exactly makes sense to cut the rotation down and ride with the guys who can put it in the hoop.
Good news is Florida State's giving up a lot of points this year.
They've exactly.
They've been pretty good defensively the last couple of years. They have some height, but this team has given up a few points. So if Notre Dame is going to get themselves at least back inside of that NCAA tournament bubble, you got to win this one.
Oh,
you got to win
absolutely.
This one, or you have to seal the one Monday at North Carolina. And Tom Noy feels like there's a chance they can win that game. It's going to be a trap game after Duke and NC State. Might be a letdown for North Carolina at home. I like his way of thinking. Hopefully that turns out. But they've got some making up to do in the ACC. They got to figure out a way to steal some victories on the road, which is obviously very, very tough. That's why you got to win this game against Florida State. You lose this game, you kind of feel like you lose all the momentum. And I don't know how much momentum you can gain from one win, but after losing seven in a row, I bet you the guys are sticking their chests out a little bit, feeling pretty good because it had been so long since they had enjoyed a victory. I mean, think back to that Syracuse game.
I know.
That was the last time they had won a game. Pretty remarkable.
It is amazing. But you're running out of games now if you want to have a shot to make the NCAA tournament. And I think it is still a realistic goal that they can make the tournament, but they've got to get hot. The part of the selection process is you look at your last 10, 12 games or so, and now they're at seven games remaining in the regular season, and you're right. You look at these next three, Florida State at Carolina, at BC, home against Miami. So even if you don't win that North Carolina game on the road on Monday on that quick turnaround, this game is absolutely, absolutely must have if they are holding out any hopes of getting into the tournament.
Mike Bray met the media yesterday. Here are a couple of minutes of his comments.
They're not just smothering you like maybe some of those Florida State teams of old. So I think for us, if we get into those 80s, we're feeling good offensively. It helps us all the way around.
Farrell and Mooney, how are they both feeling?
I think they're both feeling really good. You know, I think you could see with Matty, he was close to 100% on Tuesday night. And then, you know, another couple days of practice. I think he's back. I think Johnny's back at 100%. I thought his performance, again, was great. And we obviously need him healthy for us because he scores for us.
What do you think the atmosphere is going to be like on Saturday?
Yeah, I think it's going to be great. Certainly an honor to welcome back the 78 Final Four team. I mean, they're truly an inspiration for me and our program. So that is a nice added caveat. But this game's been sold out for a while. You know, this was I think Florida State does something to our fans, you know, all the way across the board, gets them ready to go. So I believe, you know, we'll have a great atmosphere and we'll need it. You know, our atmosphere have helped us believe this year. Our crowd, I can't thank our crowd enough and our students for having our back, you know, through a tough stretch, but, you know, coming back out and trying to help us.
Of his comments from yesterday. Sean and Darren with you. Sports Beat brought to you by Budweiser. Coming up next, you'll hear from Mike Elston. We'll have rapid fire. Final results on our Twitter question of the day, all coming up on 96.1 FM WSBT. Sports Beat brought to you by Budweiser on 96.1 FM WSBT. Sean Stiers back at our WSBT studios. I'm Darren Pritchett at Notre Dame's Compton Family Ice Arena. The Irish and the Buckeyes, two top six teams in college hockey, meeting tonight at 7:35 on our sister station, Z94.3 FM. We've got rapid fire coming up later on in this segment. Right now, Eric and I had the chance to talk to Notre Dame associate head coach and defensive line coach Mike Elston on National Signing Day on Wednesday, and this is what the conversation sounded like.
Coach Elston, the Adamalola twins, kind of a unique situation, recruiting two people in the same household. Is that unique, and what do you see from them on tape?
Well, it is unique for us to have twins coming here at Notre Dame, but I just see, you know, young guys that are explosive, that have been well trained with their hands and ability to play the game of football at the defensive line position. They love to play, very successful, you know, passionate about it. So it's exciting that they're going to be coming here, and I wish they were here right now, but I got to wait till June to get them.
What do you think about the potential for Jason to play early? What would he have to do to get in that mix?
I think for both of them, you know, we don't go into, you know, a fall camp or even a summer conditioning thinking that we're going to redshirt anybody, so especially up front, you know, because injuries happen so quickly. But I think both of them, if they come in and they can learn the defense, learn the communication, and show that they can physically hold up, you know, with the rigors of college football, which I believe they both can, and even Jamion for that fact, you know, then I believe that they can come in and give us some much-needed snaps and depth, and if need be, you know, a bigger role if, you know, knock on wood, if anything were to happen.
Is Jamion a better fit for the nose guard and Jason for the defensive tackle? Is that how you're looking at those two?
Yeah, that's how we have it slotted. You know, Jamion being a nose guard and Jason being a D-tackle, three technique.
This was the first time you've had kind of a two-stage recruiting cycle. What did you learn from this, and what do you feel like Notre Dame did well in using the new rules?
Yeah, well, what I enjoyed about it was the fact that you get 21 guys committed and signed in December, and then over the holidays you can actually take a little bit of a breath and not worry about a guy calling you on Christmas Eve saying, "Hey, Coach, I'm changing my mind." You know, and then you move forward with the positives, where you move forward with the needs that you have and address them, because, you know, end of the season happens and excuse me, you got attrition in certain areas that you didn't know you were going to have. And I had an emergency on deck with Tillery possibly leaving, you know, Bonner, you know, hanging it up. And there was even conversation with Jay Hayes at times, you know, so the D tackle position for me was scary. But you know, we're able to recruit those guys back, and so it's going to be what was potentially a poor position for us, you know, or a young position for us, now is going to be the strength of our defensive unit. So, you know, but anyway, the needs, you can move forward with your needs in January, which is nice.
Mike, as you think about last year's group of Yule and also Wardlow going through the redshirt, what were they able to accomplish last year?
Yeah, you know, they learned a lot of football. It was fun. Darnell was in a unique situation where he came from a school and didn't get a lot of training, you know, on how to play the game of football, defensive line, and a little bit of a mauler and attacker, and which is good. You want to have that, but he's got to learn how to fundamentally play the game, and he's learning that. So he got a lot of great reps with that last year. And then Kofi's going to be a darn good football player, and he's putting on weight. He's stronger. He's going to add a lot of good things for us this spring.
I'd just follow up on Darnell. I mean, do you think he would be in a position to have year? Is he sanded out the rough edges enough that he could do that?
Yeah, how about if I answer that at the end of spring? Okay. I'm encouraged by his growth. But, you know, we gotta wait to see how far his growth is actually for the spring practices.
You mentioned Tillery coming back and Bonner and so forth. What did you sell Tillery on coming back? What was the selling point? Why do you think he made the decision to come back?
Well, I think there was a consistent message from, you know, everybody that was in his ear here at Notre Dame, and he, you know, Jerry and I, and we've built a great relationship. He knows he can trust me. He knows I have his best interest in mind, and if he was truly a first round draft pick at this point, or a second round draft pick, and he was going to have secured money, then hell, I would have helped him pack his bags, you know. But at the end of the day, he's not yet. He's got three or four things to work on. We identified those things that him and I met on. And I heard the same message from Coach Kelly. Coach Kelly did some great research with the NFL executives and GMs and gave Jerry just some concrete, solid numbers. And he listened, you know, and his parents were on board, and his parents knew what was best for him. And sometimes when they have someone else in their ear that says something different than what we're saying, then that becomes the issue. But everybody was on the same page, and it worked out well.
You got different rules coming up this year that hadn't been implemented yet. The earlier official visits, what impact do you think that'll have for Notre Dame specifically, if that's an advantage? And then also, because you have these early official visits, is Irish Invasion still going to be such a centerpiece with what you do with recruiting?
Yeah, well, there's a lot of layers to that question. I think, you know, most likely the Irish Invasion disappears. I think that what you end up having is, and that's a good question for Coach Polian, you know, the recruiting coordinator. But the you know, you got to be selective with your spring visits. It's going to be crucial to make sure that you're picking the right guys to come, because if a guy's going to wait until January and February to make his decision, a visit in April is not going to do well for you. And now if he's an early enrollee, or if he's a, hey, coach, I'm going to make my decision in the summer, and you feel good that he'll stick by making that decision, then maybe you potentially bring him in the spring. But, you know, we're doing such a great job, at least at my position, D-line, to get guys here on campus unofficially, that, you know, we should have a really good idea of who we're going to official an unofficial visit here this summer.
Last thing from me with the change, with Mike Elko leaving to go to Texas A&M, when you and Clark sit down with the rest of the staff, how similar is the scheme going to be? Did you want to tweak it a little bit, or do you feel like this is pretty much what Mike Elko was running?
No, you know, I think, again, another great question for Coach Lee, but from my perspective, you know, it's going to have a similarity to what we were doing a year ago. Obviously, we're going to quality control and watch every clip from last season and make the tweaks, make the changes, goods and bad, and obviously Clark will add his flair to it, and things that he feels strongly about, I'll give my input when needed and when asked, and you know, we'll be able to improve the defense and move forward, and it'll be very similar in structure, but you know, there'll be some uniqueness to it too.
One quick follow I thought of, Kurt Heinisch, what kind of a dancer is he? I know he went to the dad-daughter dance.
You know, it's from what I understand, my kids told me that he outdanced me from the last time, but he sweat a heck of a lot more than I did. So my kids, they didn't get as wet with the sweat when I was dancing with them.
Mike, thanks for the visit. We'll see you this spring.
Thank you.
Yeah, Kurt Heinisch took Mike's daughter to the dance, so Kurt obviously did a pretty good job.
Twinkle toes.
That's right. Sean and Darren with you. It is 26 minutes in front of the top of the hour. Before we get to rapid fire, Twitter question of the day on my Twitter account at 961 SportsBeat. Who will score more points the rest of the Notre Dame basketball season? You had two choices, Matt Farrell, TJ Gibbs. It's a runaway Gibbs with 75% of the vote. How would you vote?
I think I would lean toward Gibbs as well. He's just on a roll right now. From a scoring standpoint, he would definitely get my vote.
There you go. You're along with the majority. Now let's get to some rapid fire as SportsBeat continues. They're on WSBT.
All right, let's start with a Notre Dame football question. Fill in the blank on this one. Just saw this today. Malik Zaire coming back to throw to Irish receivers at Notre Dame's Pro Day workout is blank.
Interesting.
To say
because,
the least.
Well... This is not being critical. I think I'm being honest, but he's more of a runner than a passer.
Yeah.
And if you've got guys trying to impress NFL scouts running routes, then I have a hard time doing somersaults over the fact that he's going to be delivering the football. I mean, your co-host on Leprechaun Legion, I think, would give those guys just as good a chance, if not better. Evan Sharpley.
I think you're probably right about that. I think interesting is a really good word, but that's kind of the conundrum that they're in. Who does throw to these guys at Pro Day? Because obviously Brandon Wimbush had his own issues throwing the football this season. By the time Pro Day comes around, though, I don't know that it's going to matter a whole lot. For the receivers, really, there's one wide receiver, Equanimee St. Brown. There's a tight end, Durham Smythe. Then you've got running back Josh Adams. But they've all been invited to the NFL Combine later this month. So they're going to, from the route and all that kind of thing. I think the biggest thing is how fast they run, how high they jump, how do they run their routes, and how are their hands when the ball is there. So while Zaire isn't necessarily going to do them a lot of favors potentially as far as ball placement and the whole thing, I don't know that it's necessarily really going to hurt them because he's the one throwing the balls. I mean, you'd like to have excellent ball placement all day, but you kind of get what you get. And again, they're going to have been through the ringer already. So unless they really have something to show by the time Pro Day comes around, I don't know that it's going to really affect their stock that much.
I hope you're right.
I think we all
It'll be interesting to have Malik back, that's for sure.
Yeah, yep. Okay, with Josh McDaniels staying with the Patriots in mind, which of these situations is potentially the better one? Following Bill Belichick in New England, probably without Tom Brady, or at least without Tom Brady in the very near future, or taking over the Colts, possibly, without Andrew Luck. And this is doesn't necessarily just apply to McDaniels, but which situation, ultimately, if you're a head coach and you could choose between those two, would be the better one?
Wow, that's a multi-layered answer, because you're not going to have Brady. Garoppolo just got the hugest contract in NFL history with the San Francisco 49ers.
Right.
They're going to draft a quarterback in this year's draft. So without knowing who that quarterback is, I also have to follow in the footsteps of arguably the greatest coach in NFL history.
Exactly.
That's not exactly something I'm thrilled about. If I take over the Colts, you're saying, and you're setting up with a question that there would be no Andrew Luck, correct?
Yeah, that's the, in this scenario, no Andrew Luck potentially.
Gosh. You know,
because you still don't know, right? I mean, no, I don't think anybody knows, and maybe that was part of the tipping point that sent McDaniels back. So,
Sean, I'll say this. If Luck was playing, I would say Colts. If you don't have him, I would just stick with the Patriots, just because their front office would still be in place, even though Belichick is so vital to them gaining talent. I would just roll my chances with the New England Patriots, even though I got to follow a legend. That's not something I want to do. But the Colts roster right now doesn't exactly excite me.
No, that's very true. Well, you take Andrew Luck out of it, and it doesn't look good. But you do have still a relatively new general manager who's committed to building this thing. He said all the right things, obviously, this week. I think that following the legend thing, especially without knowing who your franchise quarterback in New England is going to be going forward, I mean, that's big. It hasn't really worked out. Traditionally, you can go back through NFL history following the guy, whether it's Lombardi, Chuck Knoll in Pittsburgh, Don Shula at Miami, whoever it happens to be. I mean, following that guy has just not worked out. The few ones I can think of is George Seifert following Bill Walsh in San Francisco. But even that, I think, is different, because that was still pre-free agency, and Seifert had Steve Young after they decided to get rid of Montana. So you had the quarterback in waiting sitting there. Again, completely different situation, but that is one of the very few ones I can think of that's ever worked out where you follow the guy, even if you come from within the system. I mean, following that guy is going to be really tough, and Belichick just has his fingerprints all over everything there in New England. And as we've talked about, it traditionally also hasn't worked out for Patriots assistant coaches when they become head coaches.
I don't know if this would match up with the list you're trying to put together, but would Barry Switzer count?
See, it's so short term. And even then, because like I thought about Jimmy Johnson following Landry, but that's a completely different situation too, because you've got it. You had a new owner, and the Cowboys were going downhill at that point in the late 80s, and they completely overhauled everything. And again, Switzer had some short-term success, but he was gone after, 3 years? So
I think the players had had enough.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Well, that was such a unique situation anyway, because Jimmy Johnson was kind of more Belichick. I mean, he pushed the players hard, and there were a lot of guys like Troy Aikman and some of the really good ones who didn't think that Barry Switzer was tough enough on any of them.
Wow.
So,
that's interesting.
Yeah. Okay. Training camp starts, or a spring training rather, starts next week for Major League Baseball, but there are more than 90 free agents who remain unsigned. IMG Academy in Florida is going to host the free agent spring training, but Scott Boras's clients, they're not going to participate. So just what do you make of this whole situation going on right now?
In my opinion, two things have led to this stale free agent market. In my opinion, Sean, number one is pretty much all teams are breaking down the same numbers. They have all the same analytics at their disposal. And I just think a lot of them are figuring out ways to improve their teams without spending boatloads of money and doing multi-years. I think the other part is too many teams have gotten burned by these multi-year contracts. Nobody wants to go down that road anymore, especially with pitchers. So, again, I think everybody is playing with the same analytic data, and they all have their war and output and what each player is worth in their opinion, and nobody, I shouldn't say nobody, but I would say 90% of the time, teams are not willing to overpay right now for some of these guys. The fact that Hosmer wants 8 years, reportedly, I know he's a younger free agent, but is he out of his mind? I guess it's okay to want it, but to expect it, I just don't see anybody giving 8 years to a first baseman. That's not a premier position. Shortstop, third base, outfield, those type of guys get the big contracts. I just don't overpay for a first baseman. So I think it's the analytics. Everybody's using the same data, and everybody is putting a number on these players, and they're not going to go over it. And the other thing is, I think people are just scared off by these long-term deals. Not many work out.
No, you nailed all the points. And like to Hosmer, he's not even a traditional first baseman. He doesn't have the power that most first basemen have. So really, he's built for Kansas City. He's built for Fenway Park and not a whole lot of places in between because of his skill set, because he's not a guy who's going to go out and hit 30 to 50 or 40 whatever home runs a year. And you look at these Boris clients, and there was a time when Boris was probably a couple steps ahead of everybody because he had all that information with his 100-page binders where he'd come out, and he's the one who held all the data. But as you said, it's baseball that has all the data now that's refuting anything that Boris is trying to say. They know that these long-term contracts are not worth it. I mean, his binders with all the data, they're about as obsolete as a CD now. You can't even buy a CD at Best Buy anymore, they announced this week. So what's the use in all of it? I mean, Lorenzo Cain is the smart one right now because, like everybody, he wanted a long-term contract too, but he compromised a little bit. He got a little bit shorter deal at 5 years, but he's still going to make $80 million. I mean, he's still going to get a pretty good paycheck. Just compromise a little bit, get on a team, and go play baseball and get paid. Well, you know,
I guarantee you that's one player that got overpaid. I just can't believe the Brewers numbers said that this guy's worth $5 and $80. I think they are one of the few teams that overpaid so far in this offseason. I love him as a player, but I would not give him $5 for $80.
Yeah, it's tough, but they obviously jumped in. And I saw that Boris guys like Jake Arrieta and Mike Moustakas truly feel like they're really ticked off about this whole thing, and they fully think that they deserve one of these 7-8 year contracts, whatever. And especially for Arrieta, I don't see it. And for Moustakas, who's had one really good power year, I don't see it either.
If it's true that JD Martinez was offered 5 for $115 by Boston and he and Boris turned it down, then you know what? They deserve to sit.
No, that's exactly right.
Have fun.
Exactly right. Fair or foul on this one? Philadelphia Eagles fans starting a petition to ban NBC's Chris Collinsworth from ever calling another Eagles game.
Ridiculous.
I mean, I knew which way you were going to go, but
I mean, everybody believes that every announcer hates their team.
Yep.
I mean, that's Joe Buck. I mean, his Twitter feed sometimes is just comical. So you won the Super Bowl. It's your first Super Bowl, your first title since 1960, and you're worried about Chris Collinsworth, who is just giving his opinion, right or wrong, forget about it. Come on. You're a tough city. You're Rocky Balboa, and you're worried about that. Forget about it.
Exactly. Go have a cheesesteak. Have some fun. Relax. I mean, go put that tape of brats. Jason Kelce in again. But, I mean, by definition, a fan is someone who's overzealous and full of his own bias. And anytime you hear this bias stuff about announcers, it says more about the person who's pointing the finger at the announcer than it actually does the announcer. It's just a no-win situation. And it goes to writers as well. Like we were just talking about baseball, Tim Kurchin, Ken Rosenthal, any of those baseball writer guys, they'll tell you that every fan of every team thinks that they hate their team, and it's just because they're giving opinion, they're being honest with the things that they're talking about, and because of the fan bias, they don't see it that way.
I know through the years being around here that I can say 9 absolutely wonderful things about the Chicago Cubs and say one negative that turns out to be true, and guess which one I hear about?
That's the way, yeah, that's exactly it.
But I'm the Cardinal fan that's a hater. It's like, I'm just calling it as I see it. I don't know what else to do. Yep. I criticize my team. So if I can criticize my team, I can criticize another team.
That's exactly right.
At least I think. I begin to wonder.
Do we have time to keep going, or do we need to take a break?
Let's do one more.
Okay.
What the heck?
Okay. Another Eagles-related question. Fill in the blank on this one. I don't know if you saw this or not. You probably did. There's an Eagles fan who stole his seat at the Super Bowl last week when he left U.S. Bank Stadium. So this guy takes his Super Bowl seat with him. He's an Eagles fan. He goes to the game. Now all he has to do is pay $125 to replace the seat. No charges or anything else. So all things considered, that is blank.
How do you get out of the stadium with all the security?
Well, and that's the thing. They've actually got video of him that apparently has gone viral. Hundreds of thousands of hits on social media. They've got video of him doing it, and they managed to find him after the fact, but he had taken the seat with him by then. Apparently he brought in tools and the whole thing and took the seat with him.
So what was your question?
So what? All things considered, all you have to pay is $125 for a Super Bowl seat. What do you think about that?
Pay the $125 and get out of Dodge.
Yeah, I mean, to me, it's a great situation. You go to the Super Bowl, your team wins the Super Bowl, because let's say that the Vikings decided to auction off some of those Super Bowl seats and replace them. You're probably going to have to pay $500 minimum if those things go to auction. I think that's a pretty good deal. You've got the souvenir of a lifetime. You get to keep forever your seat from the Super Bowl that your team won.
I have two seats from Busch Stadium 2, and I had to pay a little more than $125, so I think he should take that and run and be happy.
I bet you had to pay more than $125. Yeah, that's... it's a pretty good deal, I think.
I think it was $225, if I remember right. So
that's not horrible.
That's a Super
either.
Bowl seat, though.
Yeah, Bowl seat. The Super Bowl. Yeah, that's right.
Crazy. Had not heard that story. Nothing surprises me. All right, we'll take a timeout. We'll set up the Irish hockey game. And, Sean, you can pass along some Mishawaka basketball details next as Sports Beat continues on WSBT. Sports Beat, 6 minutes in front of the top of the hour. Sean and Darren with you. Sean is the voice of Mishawaka Cayman football, and it sounds like you get a couple of days off.
That's right. No game tomorrow night. We were scheduled to have Mishawaka against Wawasee tomorrow night at 7:30, but Wawasee, everything is pretty much canceled tonight. So Wawasee was supposed to play Goshen tonight. They've moved that to tomorrow since it's a conference game. That takes priority. So instead of Mishawaka Wawasee tomorrow, Valentine's Day. February 14th. All the ladies are going to be real happy about that one, but we'll have it February 14th here on WSBT.
I hope you're not in trouble.
I don't know if I am, but my cohort Vince will be there. I think he's going to be in more trouble than me. So,
okay, well, good luck to both of you.
Right.
On that one. All right, so no Mishawaka basketball or at least here on WSBT Radio the next couple of days. Notre Dame hockey, number one in the country, takes on number six Ohio State. They beat the Buckeyes twice in Columbus earlier this year. If Notre Dame wins in regulation or in overtime tonight, they are Big Ten regular season champions. Anything else, they would have to clinch tomorrow night against Ohio State. Key stand of the night, when Ohio State scores first this year, 12 wins, no losses, 2 ties. When Notre Dame scores first this year, 17 wins, 1 loss, and 2 ties. So do you think the first goal of the game might be pretty important tonight and tomorrow with these two teams getting together?
Pretty impressive stat.
Yes, indeed.
Yep, no kidding.
Yes, indeed. So we've got Irish hockey against Ohio State on our sister station, Z94.3 FM. Pre-game coverage at 7:20, opening face-off sometime between 7:35 and 7:40, or whatever TV tells us we are going to play. We'll take our final break, wrap up Sports Beat next on 96.1 FM, WSBT. Budweiser's Weekday Sports Beat brought to you by Budweiser. Great times are waiting. Grab some Buds. Sean, enjoy your weekend, and we will speak again on Monday.
You too. You're warmer inside than outside. Have a good call this weekend.
That's rare. You come to a hockey arena. It is now the top of the hour at WSBT South Bend.